Life sure gets busy, doesn't it? Well, we understand. With all the certifications you have, finding the right kind of continuing education that fits your schedule can be a real challenge. That's where the FlightBridge Ed podcast subscription comes in. For less than $5 a month, the FlightBridge Ed podcast subscription gives you top-notch accredited CE while you listen. Visit FlightBridgeEd.com for more information or to sign up today. The FlightBridge Ed podcast subscription, another way we're being your partner in discovery.
What is a lighthouse? It is a tower with a bright light at the top, located at an important or dangerous place. The main purpose of a lighthouse is to serve as a navigational aid and to warn of dangerous areas. Welcome to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. Illuminating the darkness of current EMS clinical practice with the bright light of science. Here are your hosts, Dr. Jeff Jarvis and Mike Verkest.
Well, thank you, Ginger. Hey, everybody. Mike Verkest, Dr. Jeff Jarvis, and Eric Bauer joining us with this combination of the FlightBridge Ed podcast and maybe for some of you, an introduction to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast that is with Dr. Jeff Jarvis and myself. So, gentlemen, how are we doing tonight?
Man, I'm doing great. Eric, well, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for inviting me. I love the progress that you guys have made and really excited about this project. And thank you both for putting in the time.
We've got some cool stuff on the horizon for the EMS Lighthouse Project. And so we'll get to that more. So welcome to episode 4 on the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. And really, maybe, like I said, maybe this is episode 1 for you on the FlightBridge Ed side. But we're going to start off with a case. And Dr. Jarvis, why don't you kick this off a little bit and give us this scenario that you've been brewing on?
Well, actually, why don't we do it the other way around? So, Eric, okay. You had mentioned that... because I was kind of talking about a test question I had for my medics, but I think that might be really localized just to our protocols and a point that I was just trying to make. So, Eric, you had a case that you were talking about where you ended up putting some pacing pads on a patient with some bradycardia. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so let's just say we have a 75-year-old male patient that is at a doctor's appointment with his daughter and just starts feeling lightheadedness and some weakness. He had just been discharged from hospital about a week prior for congestive heart failure and CHF. Lasix was increased to 80 milligrams twice a day, so pretty big dose. And he just, you find him sitting in a chair. He seems to have good color. Respiratory rate is normal, about 16 to 18 breaths per minute. And you feel his pulse. His pulse feels a little bit slow to you. And so we put him on the cardiac monitor, and his rate is right around 65. So initially, you know, you don't see anything. And the staff actually hands you a 12 lead. His 12 lead looks fairly normal. He is in left axis deviation, but it's physiologic. And you don't really see any irregular rhythm. So you don't really see the AFib that he is saying that is standard for him. And so move over to the gurney, you put him on the monitor, and again, same type of a rate in the 60s. So moved him down to the ambulance and cycled a blood pressure, and his blood pressure cycled at 72 over 40. I looked at the monitor and his rate was down to 41. Very narrow complex, so it wasn't wide. And so started a line on him, started a little bit of fluid, gave him just about 250 cc's. That was all I really wanted to give him. And his rate would fluctuate. It would go from 40, 45 to 60 and then come back down. Always staying narrow complex.
So Eric, I've got a question for you though.
All right.
And this is a harken back to black or white or 50 shades of gray.
Yeah.
So, boy, it just seems like atropine would have just been the miracle answer here. Why? I mean, his heart rate's low for crying out loud. His blood pressure was heading down for crying out loud.
Why didn't you just jump on this guy and just like do all these protocol driven interventions?
Well, and I think that that's all how we've been taught. I've always been very leery about atropine. I've always been, and I don't know if it was just the instructors that we both have had and,
sure.
and the colleagues that we've worked with. You know, I learned very, very early on from Mark Waring that, you know, just because the symptomatic bradycardia protocol through ACLS or the algorithm says atropine for any bradycardia, you know, you have to look at the big picture. And although that I have given atropine in some rare cases, usually it's worked in very narrow, complex situations like this. I really have to almost be proven that that is the best choice. And I just wasn't just, I guess, with his history. And I'm always looking at the big picture, you know, is he having an MI? Why is he bradycardic? And so I thought, well, I'm going to give a little fluid and kind of look at him from that perspective. Second blood pressure after a little fluid came up to 89 over, I think, 52-ish. Rate, again, was fluctuating between 40 and 50. So I just, you know, and maybe I would have went to the point of maybe pacing. I always think that that's, for me, that's something that I can do that, I don't know. And maybe it, again, it comes back to the atropine and just how I was taught, you know, maybe, and I know there are a lot of paramedics and physicians that would have went right to atropine. And maybe that's where medicine is so broad and objective that maybe there's not a right or wrong answer. I probably, if I would have been in a transport situation where I would have a long transport, I probably in that situation, if I couldn't got his blood pressure up, I probably would have went to pacing. And I actually placed pacer pads anterior posterior and was ready to do that, had the monitor hooked up for that and was ready to pace him. But I was literally right across the parking lot from the hospital. So had a little 0.1 mile transport. so I didn't really have much time to do anything.
So I want to make sure, I'm just going to repeat the case to make sure that I understand it. You have a mid-70s-year-old male who sounds like he has some symptoms, but is not overtly, oh my God, sick. I believe what I heard was some lightheadedness, perhaps.
Yes.
And it sounds like he was clearly hypotensive. His blood pressure was in, what'd you say, the 60s, 70s initially?
70s, okay. Yeah, 70s.
What was his MAP, do you recall?
Man, I'd have to calculate it. I mean, I can calculate it really quick while you guys are talking.
But his heart rate initially was in the 40s. Did I get that right? And then would kind of, okay. And you said it was a narrow complex. What was the rhythm? Could you see P waves?
Yeah,
I know he had a history of AFib.
Yeah, P-waves. It wasn't junctional, but it definitely wasn't AFib.
And I'm sorry, Eric, you said he did have P-waves, or
he did have P-waves? Yes,
did. Okay. Yes. You know, and I heard that they had just recently bumped up his Lasix. Sounds like they doubled it.
Yeah.
Was he on beta blockade?
No, he was not.
So interesting. If he had heart failure, it's kind of interesting that they didn't have him on some beta blockers. So I was thinking maybe what they actually did is over-diuresed him. He's dry, and that's the reason he's hypotensive, and you're not seeing a compensatory tachycardia because of the beta blockade. So that's kind of interesting. So that wasn't it.
Yeah.
Dr.
Jarvis.
And your 12 lead clearly not showing any signs of ischemia, and he's not really having ischemic symptoms, maybe some lightheadedness.
Correct.
I don't know, man. I think I probably would have given him a little whiff of atropine or pacing. And I probably, since he sounds like he's pretty alert, I don't know that I would have pissed him off with the pacing. And here's my thought on it. And I think this is one of these situations where I'm not sure that there really is a clear-cut answer. I think if he had been more altered, I think there probably would have been a much better case for just going directly to pacing. But he's hypotensive for a reason, and we have to figure out why. So if you are bradycardic, obviously we know cardiac output is your heart rate times your stroke volume, and then your blood pressure is your cardiac output times your systemic vascular resistance. So it seems like we might be able to make a decent case in a 75-year-old that he's not tolerating that heart rate. Now, if his heart rate were in the 60s, I'm not really sure I could count. I could blame that blood pressure on a heart rate of 60. And I think I would probably just not even vaguely try to raise his heart rate. And I would start looking for other issues. Maybe it's a cardiogenic shock. Maybe it's sepsis. I mean, he's from a nursing home, so sepsis is probably always pretty high on my differential. So I think I might have given him just a whiff of atropine and seen what happened.
So his initial rate was 61. And so that was my initial thought. Like, that didn't scare me a bit.
Yeah.
Honestly, when I started cycling the blood pressure and we started heading down the elevator, once I noticed it, we were loading him in the car, in the ambulance. And mm-hmm. so I had one low blood pressure. I checked another one shortly after that, just to make sure it wasn't one of those, whims, because it was a mechanical blood pressure.
Sure.
But no, I agree. And he was very alert. His skin color and temperature looked good. He wasn't pale. He wasn't diaphoretic. I mean, he wasn't in distress. He just said he just kind of felt weak. And so, and I fully agree that would have been one time with a narrow complex like that where atropine would have been, warranted. I've even had some cases where, not where I've initiated it for this, where I've had hospitals initiate dopamine drips, just small dopamine drips at 5 mics per kilo per minute.
Try to get a little beta action.
For low rate problems. And it's worked really, really well, for those patients. Not something that, many paramedics go to for a rate problem right off the bat, but, we discussed in other cases like that, the one that I'm thinking of, do we continue with the dopamine? It's doing well with the rate, it's increasing the rate, or do we discontinue it and just maybe give some atropine and we continue the dopamine and he did really well. Different case, different situation, but no, I fully agree. I mean, I think there are lots of different dynamics that change based on, as you both know, transport time. And I literally had a 1 or 2 minute transport time.
And the truth is, there's probably not, with the symptoms he has, there's not really a wrong way to do it. I'm just kind of thinking, I like to eliminate the concept of transport time. And this is not a practical standpoint from any, you got to think about it when you're actually there. I'm thinking more about it from an academic standpoint, just because what I do with calls is I'll frequently take the call. Okay, well, I know what happened in that case, but I'm going to change a couple of elements and say, what would I do? How would I approach this differently if this were different? So let's try that. And again, this is just for an academic discussion. Let's take that case and tweak it a little bit. And let's say that he's got a blood pressure. Well, let's say his heart rate's 40. Let's leave it at 40. It is a sinus rhythm and, clearly narrow complex, but you got beautiful P waves, not a block, and his blood pressure is, and let's say he's altered. So he's confused and you have a blood pressure of, I don't know. Let's go with 140 over 85. So 75 years old, he's altered, he's confused, and your blood pressure, sinus bradycardia at 40. So now you've got to give the atropine, right? Because he's altered and his blood pressure is 40.
No.
Well, I mean.
No?
I would say.
You just throw that turd out there, see if anybody bites on it.
Well, no, this is what I would say. And again, this is sort of my system that I'm in. So it's fairly clear in our protocols that, atropine doesn't have to be the big devil that we think it is. And so if you want to give a dose of atropine while you're getting the norepi drip ready, you can totally do that. Or while the pacer is getting on, or, whatever it happens to be. So, I mean.
So Mike, I think maybe my signal may have dropped out a little bit. So we've changed this case a little, right?
Yes.
So now, dude, he's altered, clearly. He's clearly bradycardic. His blood pressure is 140 over 80.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that part. I'm sorry.
Somehow I thought you might have missed that part.
Yep, I missed that. I missed that part.
Yeah, so that's why we got a turd in the punch bowl. So
no atropine.
Yeah, okay.
No atropine.
But why not, Mike? He's bradycardic and he's altered.
Well,
how can you you possibly commit this horrible malpractice by not giving this man some anticholinergic therapy?
I have
got a map of 100. That's one reason.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, so, all yeah, right. So there's.
So what does that have to do with it?
He's not hemodynamically unstable as a result of his bradycardia. So there must be another reason why he's having this bradycardia. Uh-huh. That's my answer, and that's what I'm going to stick with.
So, or the bradycardia is completely irrelevant, and maybe there's another reason for his. So let's go back to that. So Eric, you mentioned the map, and as soon as I think Mike just didn't hear the blood pressure. When he heard the blood pressure, he's like, "Oh fuck, no, I'm not giving."
Yeah, we're not doing that.
So why not? I mean, he's altered, he's bradycardic. So let's say that he is. Now you don't know the blood pressure. Okay. I'm going to change it again.
Okay.
And I'm going to tell you atropine, you give atropine to this dude, his heart rate goes up and he wakes up. Unlikely, but let's just play that scenario. How did the atropine work? Was there something about the anticholinergic that improved his mental status? Or do you think it may have had something else to do?
You're going to have a corresponding increase in perfusion, which is going to be relevant in a increase in MAP if you are able to check that. And that's the whole aspect of that.
Bingo. Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, I get this, and I'm sure y'all do too. It kind of frustrates me. I'll see a patient that comes in and they're bradycardic. I mean, hell, they may even have a first or second degree heart block. Let's say it's nice, narrow QRS, so there's not much doubt there is some parasympathetic stimulation there. So he is atropine a bull. In other words, that you think atropine could have an effect, but his blood pressure is 180 over 100, and they're altered. And your colleagues are saying, hey, you got to give atropine because he's altered. The only potential way atropine could help here is by raising the heart rate and raising the cardiac output. Well, his cardiac output's fine. So raising his heart rate isn't going to make him wake up. That's not the problem. So I think we frequently end up thinking, well, if they're altered and bradycardic, we have to give atropine. And the only way atropine can help here is by raising the cardiac output. And it does that by raising heart rate. So if cardiac output is fine, then I really don't care about the heart rate. That's not the problem.
I mean, in that case, you would almost have to make the argument from the other physicians or practitioners that would make that decision that this patient is normally so hypertensive that he's symptomatic at pressure 180, and that's unrealistic.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not going to buy that. Yeah. That is a stretch way too far. Yep, I agree. Yeah, so that's a cool point. Nice. So we're going to change it a little bit more because this is actually a patient I had yesterday. So my paramedics, some outstanding paramedics, Vivian brought this patient in to me. And it was a 73-year-old female, extensive cardiac history. We know she has congestive heart failure. Her EF is between 25 and 35. And she's normally she's still anticoagulated. She's taking Eliquis. And they said they got there because she was complaining of chest pain and shortness of breath. And this feels like her typical anginal chest pain. When they got there, she was in a paced rhythm at around 60 to 70, but profoundly hypotensive, systolics in the 60s. So they did a 12-lead, gave her some aspirin. And the 12-lead is non-diagnostic. It just shows a paced rhythm. And it was an AV sequential pacemaker. So I said, well, this doesn't look good. She is symptomatic, ashen. She's diaphoretic. She looks like crap. So they started giving her, and her lungs are clear. So they were giving her a little bit of fluid while they're hanging, mixing up a norepi drip. Started her on norepi and brought her into me. And by the time she gets in there, somewhere between classically, you know, the patient changes a little bit. And I, knowing Vivian and knowing what happened in the rest of this case, I actually mean the patient changed. So I'm not trying to say she missed it.
Oh, no.
I really don't think she did. The patient changed. And now her heart rate is in the 160s.
Hmm.
Her blood pressure is in the 150s. Now keep in mind, she's on a norepi drip. So I'm like, well, all right. I'm not really sure what's going on here. Maybe this is ischemic. Certainly seems cardiac for some reason. The norepi, God help him, is working. But now she's in a tachycardic rhythm. We get a 12-lead because our tech medicine in the room. And honestly, the tech got the 12 lead before my nurses, who had a lot of other things to do, got her hooked up to the monitor. So my first look at the rhythm was from the 12 lead, and it was atrial fibrillation with a rate of around 150. I'm like, all right, well, the good news here is that I need to slow this down. And before she was hypotensive, so I would have had to cardiovert her. Now, Vivian just gave me a ton more room to work because, you know, she's got a great blood pressure. So at the time, I didn't know what her EF was. So I gave her my little whiff of diltiazem. I gave her 10 and said, well, normally I start with 10, see how that works, and then go up from there. So 10 did not impress her at all. And while we're doing that, we're kind of backing off on the norepinephrine. And damn it, if she doesn't now become hypotensive. So now, after we probably backed off on the norepi a little too fast, this is over a period of about 10 minutes. Now our pressure's back in the 70s. Well, that was working fairly well. Why don't we turn it back on? So we started the norepi again, and got her pressure up to around 110-ish. She's still kind of feeling like crap. So we said, well, and now she's starting to throw a fair amount of PVCs, some couplets, some short runs, and she's still requiring norepinephrine. So I said, well, let's go ahead and hang an amio drip. So we gave a slow infusion and then started a drip, and pressure is still okay, but she is requiring a crap ton of norepinephrine. I'm like, well, I just don't really understand what's going on here. So by this time, I'm contemplating the infusion of the amiodarone is in, or the infusion, the initial 150 is in. We now have her on a infusion, and now she's actually having sustained runs of VTAC and looks symptomatic. I'm like, all right, well, you just made my decision for me. This is easy. Have some pressure, so I gave her just a tincture of Versed, hoping that maybe she'll not hold this against me. And lit her up, shocked her twice, and got her back into the paced rhythm that Vivian saw to begin with at 65. Unfortunately, she is still just eating the norepinephrine up. Well, I was kind of hoping we could get her rate down, and maybe she was hypotensive because of her rate. Well, that wasn't it. So she still needed the norepinephrine, and I needed to put a central line in her so I could get her up to the ICU. And the thing that I really wanted to talk about was the central line technique, but I guess we can kind of talk about that blood pressure for a while. We were talking about scenarios where the heart rate was too low and they were hypotensive, and we kind of felt like maybe we needed to raise it a little bit. In this situation, you had a patient who is hypotensive, but their heart rate's too fast. So this is a situation where we need to slow it down. And obviously we have a lot of different ways to slow it down. Electricity, maybe diltiazem, maybe some beta blockers, maybe another antiarrhythmic, like some amiodarone, which block, you know, the thing, remember the Vaughan Williams classification of antiarrhythmics? And everybody says, well, what type of antiarrhythmic is this? Is this a class one, a 1A, 1B? Yeah. This is a two. And the answer with amiodarone is always yes. It's like, yeah, it does all that shit. Yeah. So anyway, interesting case.
Yeah, it was for sure. Well, Eric, listen, I know you're going to jump off here, and Dr. Jarvis and I are going to continue to talk about some airway stuff. So we appreciate you taking a few minutes and discussing this case with us, and hopefully we'll get you on here again, brother.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys again. Amazing job. And for all of you listeners, just leave reviews, and these are some phenomenal cases, and hopefully, you know, send us cases or ideas that you want to go over, and excited about the future.
Awesome. All right, brother. Well, thanks much, and we will talk soon.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Great talking to you, Eric, man.
Yep. All right. Talk to you soon.
All right, Doc. We, in our last episode, spoke quite fondly about the epinephrine issue.
When we last talked.
Yes. When we last talked. Seems like it was yesterday.
It does seem like it was yesterday.
Yes, doesn't
it?
We
need some sort of sound effect.
We do need a sound effect. I told you I'm going to work on getting some of those. We will have.
We got to get that.
We will have some ridiculous sound effects. There's no question about it.
I like it.
But
hey, so listen, speaking of sound effects, you know, we were listening to that intro when Ginger was talking.
Yeah.
First off, I got to tell you, I just love the sound of Ginger's voice. There is something about the way she ends that and says science. I just love the way she says that. It's almost like I get this, you know, Thomas Dolby thing.
Oh yeah.
She blinded me with science. Da,
da, da, da. Yeah. Yeah. That's good, man. That's 80s. That's that you're yeah, now, it is. Now you're talking.
So I had to drive my son, he's a basketball player and he jacked his elbow up.
Uh-oh.
So he's having difficulty driving his car. He drives a Camaro with a 6-speed.
Yeah.
So he's in my truck and I'm driving his Camaro and I hop in the Camaro. It's bright. So I put my sunglasses on as I'm backing up. He has 80s on 8 on XM. And I shit you not, Corey Hart is playing I Wear My Sunglasses at Night.
Mm.
And I'm like, man, this is – I drove a Camaro when I was his age in high school in the 80s. I'm like, man, this is perfect.
That is perfect. I mean, it wasn't night, but
– I feel – nonetheless. No, it wasn't. I feel either really young or really old.
Yeah,
I'm not sure which.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's good. It's good. I think you should feel really young. That's what I think.
I appreciate that. I'm going to go with that.
Yeah, you should.
I don't know whether it's true or not, but I'm going to stick with that.
All right, so we talked about Epi. So we're sticking with the cardiac. Yeah, we're sticking a little bit with the cardiac arrest theme because I think why not?
And it seems like what the cool kids do.
And I think there's as much confusion. Well, confusion, confustulation. Is that a word?
Oh no, but it should be.
Yeah, I mean it's sort of science-y, and it also has a little bit of a curse word in it, so it's pretty cool that way. But regarding the
there's
airway,
there's some how do people say controversy and screw it up?
I know exactly what
how
you're
saying.
How
did I say that?
But it's hard
I'm
to
trying
say
to
it
fuck
wrong.
It up and I can't. Controversy.
Controversy. I don't know. Could be.
All right.
But there is
it's
a little
odd that as a Texan, I can't screw that word up.
Yeah. But there is some controversy when it comes to airway management and cardiac arrest.
Oh, yes.
I think prior to a recent study that came out, I think most of us felt like intubation was the gold standard for that until this little paper came out called the PART study from our friend Dr. Wang. And I was actually pretty
and
involved
I was gonna
that.
Say and
yeah
another I made the, maybe someone on this podcast
I made the I actually printed out that the first page of the manuscript
cover sheet
was in JAMA and I put it in a frame and put it on a wall. I mean that's a pretty big deal.
Dude, take a look at the names on there. Henry was on there. Neil Richmond was on there. Mo was on there. And you were on there. There's some big names. You should be proud of that.
Yes, it was pretty cool. In fact, that was one of the things we were talking about with Dr. Daya was, like, that man has been published. Like, if you do a PubMed search for him, he's all over the place. But he was cracking up one day. We were talking. He's like, this is the first time I've ever been published in JAMA. And he's like, this is only the third or fourth time you've ever been published. And now you're in JAMA. He's like, you suck.
you fucker.
Yeah, exactly.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So,
well, you should be congratulated. Although, you know, one of the things that you said as you were leading off talking about PART was up until this study, people thought intubation was still the standard of care and the way to go.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure there's still some people who think that.
Of course.
Maybe one of the two people on this podcast thinks that.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt that.
So definitely, I think it is, you can probably make a really strong case that it should not be standard of care. Meaning if you don't do that, you're in
you have
violation
done something wrong.
And wrong. So yeah. I do think that PART and Airways 2 put that to bed.
Yes.
So
I think there are a few other things that those two put together that put to bed as well. And we can talk a little bit about that, but I will tell you that looking at our first paper though, that you're going to describe to us, this actually brought BVM versus endotracheal tube intubation together.
Yeah. So let's start by talking about, you know, one of the hallmarks of our last discussion was the lack of good RCTs.
Yes.
What we really were dealing with this in airway management too. So we do have a lot of observational trials, including from our good friend, Dr. Hasegawa, from Japan.
Yep.
And kind of what we know to start with, say coming into 2015, 16, 17, is from these observational studies, we saw if you were to rank survival by the type of airway management, we would see that bag valve mask ventilation, or as our French colleagues refer to it, bag mask ventilation.
Bag mask, yes.
So bag mask ventilation was way, way, way better than everything else in terms of survival. So huge mortality benefit in cardiac arrest to bag mask ventilation compared to next up was endotracheal intubation, then supraglottic airways. So that was kind of the baseline. That's where we were operating from. Survival, much better with a bag than ETI, which was a little bit better than supraglottics. Now, the problem is we talked about the challenges with observational data compared to RCTs.
Yep.
This observational data really opens you up to bias. And let's think about this. Why would survival be so much better with a bag valve than with any sort of advanced airway?
Because
in cardiac arrest, who are the patients most likely to survive?
The people we've witnessed, the people we're going to shock, people that wake up right away.
And say, don't you put that damn nasty thing in my mouth.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so there's this huge selection bias. There's a what I refer to as a time bias.
Okay.
And that was the big Achilles heel in this observational data. So the problem is, of course, bag mask ventilation is going to have much better survival, because what we're really seeing here is a surrogate marker for patients who wake up after you shock them. Now, there are all sorts of ways you can try to control for that, but you're still, you know, propensity matching and all sorts of things, but you're still dealing with that inherent bias. Maybe there is a reason they didn't get intubated.
Yeah.
So the way to answer this question would be to do a randomized control trial prospective. It's going to be kind of hard to blind this one. You're going to know whether you're ventilating through a mask or
not.
Yeah. If you can't figure that one out, maybe we have some other reasons that survival may not be good.
See, that would have been a great time to have a sound effect right there.
But
yeah, exactly.
So the first paper we want to talk about did almost that. And we'll talk about the emphasis on almost. So this first paper is The Effect of Bag Mask Ventilation versus Endotracheal Intubation During Cardiopulmonary Resuscitation on Neurological Outcome After Out-of-Hospital Cardiorespiratory Arrest, a randomized clinical trial.
Whew. That is a long title.
Holy crap. I need to get some water.
They needed somebody to work on a.
Yeah, I believe that person's called an editor. Yeah. They could have used an editor here.
They could have used a really cool acronym, in the paramedic and paramedic 2.
And we're going to have today too.
Yes, we will.
That would have been good. We didn't get it. Maybe this is. Sounds much better in French. I don't know.
Oh, it's possible.
This was a paper in JAMA, so big time medical journal. And where was the? I'm trying to find the date on this paper. It was 2018. I'm trying to remember when. All right, I don't know. So, 2018,
sometime last year.
The lead author is Patricia Jabre.
I think Jabre.
Jabre.
Yeah, let's go with that.
Let's do that. So this paper, and I'm going to kind of go over this relatively quickly, but I want to get to the methods. But with every time we talk about a study, we're going to do it in roughly the same way.
Yes.
We're going to talk about what their hypothesis was, what their intervention was, what the setting was, the inclusion, exclusion criteria, then talk about some methods where that's important, and then get to the good stuff.
Love it.
So the meat of this is don't just read the damn abstract. In the abstract, they may say things, they may draw conclusions, and if they can slide it past the peer reviewers and the editors, it gets published. That doesn't mean that's something we would agree with. So what were they trying to look at here? So what's their fundamental hypothesis. And so their background is they say that bag mask ventilation is easier, requires less skill than endotracheal intubation. You can have people with less training who can do it effectively. And therefore, because of all those things, and they also think that bag mask ventilation may cause fewer interruptions in compression.
Okay.
It may limit your ability to get up to ventilation-associated mischief, which is very legitimate. So their thought is if bag mask ventilation is non-inferior to endotracheal intubation, we should use that.
Got it.
What the fuck was that word I just used? Yeah.
It was a pretty sciencey word.
I threw that out there. Non-inferior.
Well, I mean,
so
yeah.
Here's kind of my problem with words like non-inferior. I'm kind of from the Hemingway school of writing, which is don't say in five words that which you can say in two.
Okay.
I think this methodology, and I'm sure there are some good reasons, and maybe I'm just not very good at methodology, but I think that frequently non-inferior is done by drug companies who are trying to sell a more expensive drug by saying, well, we don't suck any worse than the other guys. So I immediately get skeptical of non-inferiority trials. I also get skeptical of trials where you have to do some pretty complex math. The easier your math is to understand, the easier it is to see the connection between your hypothesis, your methods, your intervention, and your conclusion. So this is a non-inferiority study. It is not which of these two things worked better. And because of that, there are some different methods that they had to overcome. So basically, that's what their hypothesis is. Well, we think bag mask ventilation is non-inferior to endotracheal intubation. And for some math reasons that I will be perfectly honest and tell you I don't understand, that is not the same thing as saying bag mask ventilation and ETI are the same.
Okay.
There are, and we probably ought to get a statistician on who can actually explain that.
I think we have somebody in mind. At least we were talking about that last time. So we're going to definitely work on that.
And this is a tough one because I've heard people explain this, really smart people explain it 15 ways from Saturday, and it still kind of sounds like a made up answer to me.
That's funny. So what were they looking at in this? Like, what was their primary outcome?
Yeah.
What did they want to look at?
Well, so let's talk about their intervention.
Oh, okay.
So the intervention was, and now keep in mind what we're looking at here. This is a multi-center study. It is an EMS study in France and Belgium.
Okay.
So multiple agencies. Now, the French and Belgian systems are different than ours. So they have a, shit you not, they call them ambulance drivers.
Oh, okay.
That's not my word. They have, I'll call them an EMT, but it's not clear to me they actually are like our EMTs. Maybe sure. They are. They have a nurse and they have a physician.
Oh, okay.
So there were physicians on every one of these ambulances.
Copy that.
And so that system is a little bit different than ours.
Just a smidge.
A smidge. Now, the interesting thing is their ambulance drivers, their technicians, or their nurses would do the bagging, but only the physician would intubate.
Huh.
So they would have people with less training do the bag mask ventilation because everyone knows it's easier than intubating.
Huh.
And as a little hint, anytime I say everyone knows, that is usually my foreshadowing that they're wrong.
Exactly.
So what they did was they randomized the patients in cardiac arrest to have either bag mask ventilation only or bag mask ventilation followed by endotracheal intubation.
Okay.
Right. So they're going to get intubated quickly, but you're going to bag before then. So it's bag mask versus endotracheal intubation. And these are patients that are randomized at the time that they decide, hey, we need to ventilate this patient.
Do you have any insight onto how they randomized? Was it like a envelope that was opened? Was it a little lottery scratch it that they scratched and went, oh, it's BVM day? Or do you, I'm just curious, did they explain any of that?
They did. So it was actually stratified by center. Their agency, and they did it on a 1-to-1 ratio. So there's this computer that spit out these numbers, 1-to-1 ratio. It was done in clusters based on the system. So
Gotcha. Basically
your system is going to be doing bag mask for a while, then this.
It's very, very much like what we did for PART.
Yeah, very much so.
Okay.
Although I'm not sure. I can't imagine they did not do crossover.
Yeah. I'm sure they had to cross over at some point to keep the numbers sort of jiving.
You know what? I'm actually lying to you. I pulled this up. I was kind of stalling because I needed to remind myself. They randomized it based on the center, but they actually put the result in an envelope.
Oh, okay.
And then mixed them up randomly, and then you opened an envelope at the time of service.
Gotcha. So
the cluster randomization is how they generated it. What the actual crew did was open an envelope, and that told them what to do. All right. So the other interesting thing to know about this is if you do get ROSC, everybody got intubated.
Uh-huh.
And the physician, again, did the intubation. The EMT or the nurse did the bag mask. Now, they said the physician had overall responsibility. Yeah, I'm not sure that that means that they were really paying much attention to the bag mask ventilation, if my experience
tells you anything.
Yeah. Right. So that was the intervention. The outcome they were looking at is a CPC score of 1 or 2 at 28 days. So basically functional neurologic outcome. So that's, hey, this is an outcome we really care about. So this is the nice thing. We said this prior work had this time bias.
Yeah.
The nice thing here is this is a randomized control trial, so it really does account for this. So it should help us control this. Okay. Whole lot of math that I'm just going to skip over, but basically they said you need to see a greater than 1% or less than 1% threshold in order to say non-inferiority. So there's some statistical issues here. The other issue is in order to do this, you have to have a good size population. Their inclusion criteria were adults, all-cause cardiac arrest. So all comers, all rhythms, all comers. They excluded you if you had massive aspiration. Hmm. And then the normal things, the Ps, pregnant, prisoner, DNR. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yep. All of those. They did asynchronous compression, so 30-2 for everyone. And most of these patients, they were basically, it's a randomized controlled trial. They're reasonably well-balanced groups. The vast majority were in a systole, 72% of the whole group. Only 16% were in VFib. So what did they find? Bottom line, CPC score of 1-2 using an intention-to-treat analysis, wiping your butt and paying taxes at 28 days in the bag mask ventilation group, it was 4.3% versus 4.2 in the endotracheal intubation group.
Huh.
Their confidence interval was huge, negative 1.64 all the way up to infinity. So they were not able to show non-inferiority. So they call this trial a negative trial. But basically what they're showing is, and I'm going to get out of the statistics math that hurts my brain with these non-inferiority studies and say, really what they're showing is 4.3 versus 4.2. Let's just take a look at it on its face. And that seems pretty straightforward.
Yes.
They did notice failure. So failure to adequately manage the airway. It was 2.1% with endotracheal intubation versus 6.7% with intubation, or I'm sorry, bag mask. Mm-hmm. Regurgitation, it was 7.5% with ETI versus 15% with regurgitation.
Twice as
so
much.
What they found is, there are definitely some problems with mask ventilation. And perhaps it's not as easy to do as we say it is. One of the, they had a small percentage of them that used CPR metrics, and they found that there was no difference in compression fraction. And that's probably because they were both doing 30-2.
Gotcha.
There was a much greater increase in the number of pauses more than 2 seconds. Uh-huh. So there were 16 of those in the ETI group versus on average versus 27 with the bag mask.
No kidding. And that's interesting.
Yeah. And basically they said on average, you have 11 more seconds of pauses using the mask ventilation. So they're not real clear about what was causing this, but my take here is that
adjusting they were the steel, probably aware that, farting around with the
and we know that one of the things that increases the likelihood of regurgitation and gastric distension with mask ventilation is squeezing the damn bag too fast and too hard, And when you got to get two ventilations in within a short period of time, it's hard not to do that.
Absolutely.
So my take on this, honestly, is it's kind of a pointless study. They spent a lot of time, energy, and money. I don't understand why they designed this as a non-inferiority study. They underpowered it. They can't come up with clearer conclusions. So I'm not real clear about why they set it up this way. My bottom line takeaways is that there is no clear difference in functional survival between these groups. And I think this goes directly to these initial studies that I'm a big advocate for intubation, and I was getting my ass kicked by people saying there's no reason to intubate. Survival is much higher with bag mask ventilation. And I would say, but time bias. And they said, horse hockey. And now I can say, listen, bite me. We've gotten rid of that. And look at this, 4.3 versus 4.2. I'm not buying it. And then it's not benign. Mask ventilation, there are more failures with it. There's more regurgitation. And one of the things I think is interesting is in order to say that there was regurgitation, you actually had to see it through the mask.
Wow.
Now, I think both of us have gone in, we have mask ventilated someone and did not see puke, but we put the laryngoscope blade in there and whoa, puke. There's some puke. Yeah. And that puke, even if you can't see it through the mask, is still having direct access to the
lungs.
Pneumonitis and pneumonia. So I think we underestimate the difficulties of effective bag mask ventilation. And I think it's really hard to get two effective breaths in a really short period of time.
No question.
Without increasing the interruption and compressions. So I kind of like the getting rid of the time bias. And I think it gives us a decent idea of really where we are. But the bottom line is I don't think this is going to change my practice, and I don't think it should change anybody else's practice. I think some type of advanced airway management is probably appropriate for a refractory cardiac arrest. And by refractory, I mean they don't wake up when it goes down.
You've been listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, a proud member of the FlightBridge Ed podcast family and a Fire Dog production. Visit FlightBridgeEd.com for more information.